I absolutely love the weird, and I think that's a great question. Easy for me. I wouldn't take it. What?
See? Another sane human being, Becca.
That's nuts.
Yeah, I wouldn't take it
Absolutely.
either. Alyssa, what are these people thinking? I would never have a moment of enjoyment for the rest of my life knowing I was going to be eaten by a shark at the end.
Welcome to Under Embargo, the podcast that says the quiet part out loud about PR, communications, and the chaos in between. Hosted by two of LinkedIn's most connected comms pros, Becca Chambers, a no BS corporate comms exec with raging ADHD, and Parry Hedrick, founder of tech PR firm Crackle PR. This show brings it all. Real talk, sharp insights, and the kind of industry truths they don't put in press releases. No fluff, no filters, no f's given. This is Under Embargo. Let's get into it.
Hello and welcome to Under Embargo. I am your host, Becca Chambers, CMO at Scale Venture Partners, where I am today. Actually, this is the first time I've ever done a podcast from my office, and I'm going to be really self-conscious about like people walking by. I'm going to be like, but other people do podcasts from the office, so I'm not the only nerd here. Anyway, joined as always from my co-host and with by my co-host. Wow, sorry.
With, by, beside, betwixt.
By my co-host Parry Hedrick. Jeez, hello Parry,
Hey now.
founder of Crackle PR, and today we are lucky to have a longtime communications pro who I've known for many years. We were just talking about I've known her long before I was doing the whole LinkedIn thing. She's currently the head of analyst relations at the white hot cybersecurity company Wiz, which was recently acquired by Google in Google's biggest deal ever. And she's been both the head of AR and executive communications in her 25 years on the job. She's worked at companies like Okta, SAP, and Ariba, and I'm excited to welcome Alyssa Stone to the show. So welcome, Alyssa.
Welcome.
Thank you for having me. Glad to be here.
Yeah, we are super excited to have you. And we decided since you're a friendly and you wouldn't judge me, maybe you'll judge Perry for this, but I know you, so you
I can
won't
be
judge me.
judged. I'm fine with that.
We would start the show with an icebreaker to just jump right into the weird.
Love it.
So here it is. Ready? Okay. Just caveat with we know that this is weird
Okay.
and hypothetical. You are given the choice. You can live your life, go on as currently Alyssa Stone, awesome lady, mom, badass, AR queen. Or somebody's going to write you a check for $100 million to spend however you like for the rest of your life, with the caveat that when you're 90 years old, you'll die by being eaten alive by a shark. Do you take the deal?
I absolutely love the weird, and I think that's a great question. Easy for me. I wouldn't take it. What?
See? Another sane human being, Becca.
That's nuts.
Yeah, I wouldn't take it
Absolutely.
either. Alyssa, what are these people thinking? I would never have a moment of enjoyment for the rest of my life knowing I was going to be eaten by a shark at the end.
Exactly. And I love the beach. I live near the beach. Love family, vacations, going in the ocean, rivers, all sorts of water sports. There is absolutely no way
But you
I would
get
agree
to
to that.
go and enjoy all of those things every year, knowing you're not going to get death injured by those things until you're 90 years old.
I'm
That's
sorry,
it.
friend. I'm with Perry on this.
Yeah.
You're the weird one, Becca.
I
See?
live
See?
every day worried that I might get hit by a car. Every day of my life, I am worried that I might get eaten by a shark. Knowing that I'm going to live till 90 years old, that is amazing. With $100 million, sign me up. I don't even need the 100 million.
I
Just
could
knowing
be
I'm going to live
on
to
a
90.
beautiful walk, holding hands with my lovely bride, and all of a sudden I'll be reminded that I'm going to die by getting eaten by a shark, and I'll have an anxiety attack and leave.
Exactly.
There are worse ways to die,
And
frankly.
having like a
Not many.
countdown, knowing how many years you have left.
Yeah.
No.
90. I mean, man, I don't know. Anyway,
Right.
well,
I win.
we started with that. Fine. Perry, one up for Perry. That's fine. Thank you for allowing us to jump in with that. But now I'll get to some like normal questions and then we'll probably circle back to weird because that's just how we are. But Wiz has actually, long before you were at Wiz, Wiz has been my brand crush since it like came on the scene in 2020. I was working at Mobile Iron at the time and I remember seeing Wiz come on and I was like sending my friend links. And when you and I were chatting, when you were considering joining, I remember you asked me and you were comparing two companies and I was like, don't, it's not even a question. It's Wiz all the way because the brand, are you kidding me? So I would like to say that I have very good foresight and you're welcome. But no, seriously, Wiz has a very cool brand and I would love for you to tell me a little bit about like what about Wiz brand and the cool stuff that you guys do because it is always cool. And you guys have the coolest boots and swag and all of that. Obviously the biggest brand budget also, which must be nice, but you know.
Well, I'm going to agree with you and then I'm going to disagree with you. Because okay. It's fun to do and it's actually true. So I will say that Wiz is really passionate about its brand and about its, you know, people and customers and products, and that all kind of goes together. So what I love about the Wiz brand is that it is light pink and blue and there's clouds and unicorns and it's playful. And we're a security company. So unlike a lot of security companies who I think tend to go for scare tactics and like fire and like black and red and orange and like all of this really aggressive marketing, Wiz really embraces this fun, playful, like, you know, get people engaged in security rather than having them be terrified about it. And I'll let you in on a little secret. And I actually connected with our head of brand earlier today, telling him I was going to be on the podcast, named Roy Katz. He's phenomenal. Believe it or not, he has a small team of really, really passionate and empowered brand wizards. They're creative geniuses. They're some of the nicest humans on the planet. And they do everything in-house. So when it comes to a big event like RSA, like, you know, Becca, you've seen a few of our booths. We definitely need agencies to help us execute on it. And I can't share any, you know, budgets, but we actually do a lot on more of a modest budget. Like we don't throw everything towards brand. I think it's really the creative freedom, getting employees engaged and really, you know, and really excited about it. And sure, we do spend, you know, some money on, you know, on events and on all of the great things that we do on the website and really creative things we do on LinkedIn, like a CISO musical. And we do spend budget, but it's really more about our creativity and freedom and just, you know, just having a lot of fun with the brand.
Can I ask it? You mentioned the brand team that's in-house, is they feel empowered to you know, sort of be creative and come up with great ideas and then execute. Is that a through line throughout the company in your estimation? Is that sort of, you know, part of the true north of the companies that people can feel empowered to go ahead and make bold decisions and do bold things?
You're absolutely right. And I think that's one of the secrets of Wiz's success. And it's interesting, we can pivot to a little bit of a PR angle before we talk about AR. Yeah. So, there are very, very, very little layers of management within Wiz. So Perry, I'm going to give you a quiz because you put me on the spot.
Okay.
So, you know, a little bit about Wiz, you know, about our brand presence. We don't use PR agencies. We have one local agency that we use who's phenomenal in Israel. How many people do you think we have that do PR at Wiz?
Internally? Mm-hmm. My guess would be three.
One. So, and this was until a few weeks ago. So the best PR comms pro I've ever worked with is a woman based in Manhattan named Rachel Ratchford. She's awesome. And she does PR for Wiz. She's a mom. She's phenomenal at her craft and just a really great human. And we were going through like a typical company meeting where we were talking about results from a great launch and all of these, you know, great PR results. And one of our senior executives said, "Kudos to Rachel and the PR team." And I think everybody assumed that Rachel had like five people. And then of course, in like a side chat, we'd be like, "Rachel, the PR team, you queen." And then Rachel finally hired somebody else to do PR. And so now we can no longer have that, like, you know, inside joke.
Yeah.
But
yeah,
that's a big thing at Wiz, is being empowered to say yes, and also being empowered to say no. Like, there's very little that I need to actually go to my manager to get approval on. Yeah. I usually just work directly with our C-suite executives. I certainly come up with, you know, ideas, and I run them by them and then just execute on them. So I think, yeah, for most people at Wiz, you'd probably have several people and several other layers of management at another company. We run, you know, run pretty hard and run pretty lean.
So I just need to comment on that, because it was a quiz to me. And I was off by two, and I intentionally went low. I would honestly, if you asked me that without the setup, I would have said maybe, you know, six, seven. But one thing I will say is the job that has been done is phenomenal. So kudos to the PR person, but also it helps a whole hell of a lot when you have a really cool story to tell. And that makes it a lot easier to soften the beachheads out on the media landscape. I will say that for sure. Look at the Apples of the world. They don't have a lot of agencies. Generally, they tend to have a pretty lean team internally. And the reason why is they have a halo effect on the brand, like Wiz obviously has. So no disrespect to the effort done, but it's sure a heck of a lot easier when people are like beating down your door to talk.
It is. And when you have senior executives who are really willing to engage and who really understand PR and truly, truly value it, which we have here, which is great.
And the empowerment piece that you said is super important, because let's assume that when you're hiring people, you assume you're hiring smart people. Like, that's a given. Okay. Why would you not empower those people? Why are you babysitting people that you're hiring who are smart people? And when you empower people who are smart people to like run fast and do a good job, and everybody's running fast and doing a good job, like, you can do really great things with a lean team, right? And you can do a lot of things really fast with a lean team, rather than having 19 layers of approval because you're worried everything has to be perfect, or you're the control freak who has to see everything or whatever. And like, it's so much better. I don't know. I just, like, as somebody who expects really good outcomes, but also knows how you can do that really fast, but it is reliant on having good people around you who feel empowered, and you have to be empowered as well. I think empowerment is the name of the game on that. Anyway, I want to double click on that. Yeah. So let's talk about AR then. We talked about PR. I feel like AR is a little bit, because maybe not everybody who is listening knows what AR is. Not AR is analyst relations. Let's start there. So I will start with having you kind of define what is analyst relations, and how does somebody get into analyst relations? Because honestly, it's not something that's taught in college, and most of us have never heard of it until we're working at a tech company. I worked in AR for a long time. I love AR. I personally think everybody who goes through a tech communications team, if you're in PR or exec comms or whatever, you should go and sit in analyst relations at some point, because it's one of the most valuable things you can do for your career. So tell our audience what it is, why it's awesome, how you get into it.
Absolutely.
How you got into it.
I did get into it. And I like to say, and Becca knows this about me, I love communications and marketing and product marketing, because people are really social and really fun. It's about building connections. And we have an open group here. So I like to say I started doing AR before I could order a glass of wine, which is really crazy. I discovered it so young, and I'm really, really glad that I did. And I wish more people discovered it younger. So, but analyst relations is, it's establishing a really trusted, like, bi-directional relationship where you exchange, you know, information about your products and insights between a company and a set of these technology analysts. So these are not investment analysts. I think a lot of people tend to confuse AR and IR. They're really different. These analysts are not making stock picks. They are not looking at the financial market. What they are is looking at technology and looking at companies and advising end users. So the analysts are from really big global firms like Gartner, Forrester, and IDC. Then there's a lot of specialist firms. I'm going to get in so much trouble for not mentioning one, but like, you know, 451, Futurum, Ovum, ESG, where they have like some areas that they really, really specialize in. And then there are totally independent analysts who are also really, really influential. So in, if you know, you know, cyber and cloud security, like a James Berthode or Francis Odom, they have a lot of impact, and a lot of people really overlook these independent analysts that have a really strong advice. So what these analysts do is they, first of all, they write research, the most famous being the Gartner Magic Quadrant that, you know, rates companies based on their vision and ability to execute. Forrester also has a Wave. IDC has their MarketScape. So they write reports like this that really give end users some great information to make better buying decisions. So that's like the most visible part of AR that everybody knows. And in fact, a lot of companies start there or stop there, I'm sorry, which is really, really short-sighted. Because what the analysts also do that's a little more invisible is they advise buyers like directly on their technology strategy and purchases. And then the reason why it's bi-directional and the really fun part of it is that we as companies also go to these analysts for advice on areas like our roadmap, our messaging, you know, our own strategy. So that's where it becomes this like bi-directional, we need you, you need us kind of relationship. And it's a hell of a lot of fun.
Yeah, and you get really smart doing it, right? Sorry, yeah. Go ahead, Perry.
Well, I just want to say, so I've been involved in the analyst world too. I've briefed many, many analysts at all those firms you mentioned. I've been on analyst tours back when people still did tours in person, yes. You know, which
in
was
the limo
lot.
With like the big briefing book, like the binder 100%. That you would give somebody with the profiles of the analysts.
Yeah,
and, like,
yeah, yeah.
And going then around in the limo all smushed
pictures.
Together.
Yeah.
Your briefing book had like thud weight. You're like, boom, did you have everything that you could possibly find about this analyst? What have they read? What reports have they done? And then just the logistical piece was a nightmare for somebody like me who has a little ADD, like just getting around and making sure your executives got to the meeting in time was like nerve-wracking as hell. But having said all that, so I have a little bit of a love-hate relationship with analysts, and we're keeping it real on this podcast. Yeah, so I'm gonna give you the love-hate. So there's a clear benefit, I think, for analysts, working with analysts. And I think I've just kind of always known that, always done it. We work with analysts today. Having said that, some clients and some loud voices out there in the marketing front are talking a little bit about how maybe it's a little bit of extortion to work with analysts these days, where if you don't pay enough, you don't get enough of the goodness and the recommendations and the favorability and the reports, the Wave, you know, et cetera. So I hear that and I think maybe there's something to that. But to me, the bigger question is technology catching up with analyst groups to the extent that some of these companies like a Blue Ocean or others can now put together the data that analysts take, you know, 3 months to 6 months to put together, and they can do it fast. Are analyst groups falling a little behind technologically is my question. Are you seeing any of that, or is there anything giving you pause about the speed with which or lack thereof that analysts can come to the market with new ideas? And is the information stale by the time you get it?
Absolutely. So first of all, I'm biting my tongue for a minute to not talk about the whole pay for play thing. You also just completely scooped my pet peeve. So what I will say about the analyst landscape is for the strong, reputable firms, any of the firms I just mentioned, it's not pay for play. It's pay to engage. So I'll give you a couple examples. Like I have been at like a, you know, not a small company, but a smaller company like a Wiz. I've run a big analyst team for SAP. Those are very different budgets. Those are very different investment in the analyst firms. When I was with SAP, often they would say, oh, well, yes, we have a big budget, but like these smaller, more innovative companies are sexier and the analysts want to talk with them. And, you know, they would have those kind of concerns. So I certainly didn't see when I was at SAP any huge benefit in getting like better dot position based on being a bigger company, but the pay to engage is just a reality. So, like, you know, I'd mentioned it's bi-directional. So most technology companies will be a client of many of the analyst firms that we just talked about. And for me, like if an analyst has spent time with your executives and your executives have asked them for input on roadmap, have asked them like, so what are your clients saying? Like, what are you hearing out there in the market? First of all, it is going to improve your messaging because you're taking advice from the analysts. You're also then able to like tell the analysts, actually, what you're hearing from your clients is something that we're solving. in our next release. So like, stay tuned. Or, you know what, you can tell that client who's concerned that it's on the roadmap and tell them to contact reps, we'll put them on the phone with you. So I feel like you can be much better at your job as an AR professional and as a company if you're engaging in a paid way, just because that's just how you get access to the analysts. So there are certainly paid opportunities. You can get an analyst to come on a webinar with you, but there's a lot of restrictions on that. Like, the analysts can't just talk about your company. They're going to be talking now about like their perspective on the market and how it's evolving. So it's kind of my take on that. You're absolutely right, Perry. I've seen a lot of changes in just analysts moving at a faster pace. So one is, a lot of analysts are using LinkedIn a lot more and using blogs a lot more instead of formal research. So let's say that there is, you know, an announcement that a vendor makes about an acquisition. It used to be that the analyst firm would take a couple of days, assemble a big group of analysts, put together like a very formal, you know, take and takeaways, and then it would go through like a peer review cycle, and then they would put it out. And by the time they would put out this report, it's kind of, you know, the news cycle has passed. Now there's a couple of things that analysts do. First of all, is that they can put their take on LinkedIn very quickly and other social media platforms, which is great. Often, like, you know, Forrester does this, instead of doing a formal report, they'll put out a blog. And what's great about that is that the blog is a lot quicker and it's also publicly available. So it's a great way for them to spread their news. And then kind of getting into that AR PR connection, I'm also finding now that a lot of reporters are citing industry analysts. And so then you'll get that analyst perspective out there even quicker because you're getting the analyst perspective out via a journalist.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Or there's this people, there are these analysts / journalists, right? These people who are becoming, that are not quite analysts, they're not quite journalists, they're something in between where they're doing research, they're writing, but they're deep researchers doing research on a very specific industry or something. So I don't know what you call them, but they are, you know, on whatever alternative media, or they're on LinkedIn or Substack. And I do kind of think that is the future of analysts, because the analysts can take their brand. Maybe they build their brand at Gartner and then they leave Gartner. That they're not leaving their beat at Gartner. They're taking their brand with them and they can continue to write. And maybe they're going to go write at Substack now and own the entire analyst thing now, but now they're a journalist. And I think that's really interesting to see how that will evolve. And I do think now you get the real time news or technology information. You don't have to wait for those like very long cycles. So it'll be really interesting.
Absolutely.
To see how that changes.
Well, and I think then the role, and this is where I get really excited about analyst relations, because my role, like my company looks to me to say, okay, so who should we be engaging with and why? And if you ask me, I think there's very specific reasons to be engaging with the big firms, with the medium-sized firms, and the independent influencers. And I've seen in the results from my program that you really do need all three. There are a lot of companies that just have a policy and just say, we'll just talk to, like, you know, the top two firms. To me, it's pretty short-sighted. Something else that I've been noticing is that in with some of these independent influencers, you look at their, you know, LinkedIn posts, they get it out quick. It's end users, like CIOs, decision makers who are commenting and who are engaging. And so you know that they do have, you know, have that influence. So I think there's, you know, there's room for everyone. And that's the fun part of AR, is figuring out, you know, who to kind of bring into your network and who to invest executive time in, because that's one of the most limited resources that you have, I think, across both AR and PR, is executive time. And if an executive doesn't feel like an interaction has been, you know, worthwhile or has led to, you know, a good result, you may not end up getting that executive's time again.
So I don't work personally with analysts anymore. My team does that. But I know back when I was actively doing it, we would find, you know, you name it, IDC, Gartner, Forrester, wherever, we'd try to find for our clients like a brand champion internally, like an analyst who is like ready to be out there quoted, like wants to make a name for his or herself. And that was always the magic, when you could find somebody who like believed in the product or service you offered and it was clear they were ambitious to try to make more of a name. I'm curious, does that still exist? Are you still seeing that, number one? And number two, do you think that's even more true for all the things Becca was just talking about, like the influencers who are on the Substacks of the world? Like, isn't it incumbent upon them to be quote machines, to get written about in all these publications and magazines that cover this stuff, to then make their own stock rise, so to speak?
So I'll agree with you and then disagree with you, which I seem to be liking to do today, Perry. So first of all, I agree. Finding someone, and this is like the psychology in it that I really love, and I know Becca and I have chatted about this, finding an analyst who just really likes your company and who trusts the executives and who really loves the product and gets the brand, and like you can just tell that they're an advocate for you when you're not there, that's magic. That's great. Something else that I think is magical that I love is finding an analyst or an independent analyst who is usually pretty skeptical about everything. So they have almost a reputation of being independent and being that skeptic, and then working with them and having them become maybe like a reluctant advocate or a reluctant champion, because like they don't want to be like, you know, a big fan of, you know, one brand. But I also find that there are a lot of end users out there who really like getting advice from people who are pretty skeptical about vendors.
Sure.
And so I think those individuals, and they can be at big firms. Like there are some analysts I can think of from all of the big firms and then down to the independents who have a reputation of being skeptical. And those are actually some of my favorite analysts. I like a good challenge.
What do you do to, you know, what do you do to persuade the skeptics?
Absolutely. So you actually don't even really persuade them actively. You first of all, you really have to hear them out. You really have to listen to them and just try to kind of step away from your own company. And just think, you know what? Like, do we not like what they're writing? But is there some truth to it? Okay. And then finding an executive who is very humble and can just come and have a great discussion with them and say, you know what? That isn't the most favorable part of our product, but we're going to be improving that, and this is why. Or I'm also really passionate about like this area of application development. Like, let's dig into it. I think it's engaging them, because I think a lot of vendors don't just think, oh, well, they're, you know, they're a really skeptical analyst. It's just, I would rather engage with analysts who are like really positive all the time. But it's often those analysts that are a bit more skeptical that end users tend to like keep coming back to, because they really like that edge. So it's just about, you know, finding out what interests them, finding out what they are positive about, even if they're skeptical, what they're skeptical about, and like what kind of access they want. Like some analysts really want they don't care about a C-level executive. They want to engage with someone who's a real technical expert, and they want to see a demo and like dig into the technology. And so if you have one of those analysts and you put even like your CEO on, it's going to be a mismatch. So it's about kind of finding that right balance of like what moves the needle for them and what they're interested in. And then also, you know, what kind of spokespeople you have at your company or even customers.
So talk a little bit about, and for those, again, not everybody knows what analyst relations is beyond this discussion. So I know that a lot more people that follow me, for example, know what media training is for on the PR side. And so whenever we have a briefing for, you know, a C-suite exec with a reporter, we'll do a briefing sheet, talk to them about what to expect, show the last several articles that have been written, make them, you know, put their best foot forward by having all of the information possible before engaging. Can you talk a little bit about what that's like on the analyst relations side for the C-suite when they're going to meet with analysts across the spectrum, whether it's a friendly or whether it's a skeptic? Like, how do you approach that?
Absolutely. And my approach has really evolved over the years. I used to thinking back to that like solid binder briefing book day when you would get ready to go on that analyst tour and you had every piece of information you possibly could about that analyst. That was my approach. Like, be really thorough. Don't be caught by surprise. And then I changed it. So are you familiar with the movie, The Devil Wears Prada? It's like my favorite movie. So I think this is a perfect example of kind of how I've evolved my prep. And that's like the one movie where if it's on TV, no matter where it is, like I will watch it because I love it. So if you think about, so there's Emily, who has been studying these profiles, getting Miranda ready for this like big benefit event. She's been studying them inside and out for weeks. And she's all ready to prep Miranda like at the event to make sure that when someone approaches her, she knows, you know, who that person is and that you can give her a little whisper and a little bit of background about that person. And then there's Andy, who comes into it the night before because Emily is starting to not be as great at her job as Miranda thinks. And Emily comes in and says, oh, good luck. Here are like the 28 binders of things. And then you go to the day at the actual benefit event. And, you know, Miranda says, who is that? And Emily goes, and then Andy goes, you know, that's Ambassador Franklin. And that's Rebecca, the woman he left his wife for. And that's all she needed to know. And then she goes, Rebecca, and they have a conversation. So I have one slide that is the only way I will do prep. And the C-level executives who I work with love it. And it talks about, you know, a quote from the analyst's latest research so that they can, if they have 5 seconds, they can look at it and say, okay, this is the most relevant quote from this analyst research based on what we're going to be talking about. It'll have, you know, links to what they published before. If that executive has time to read, they often don't. But then the most important thing is that it has like, what's their perception of our company? And then what are the most recent interactions that they had? So it's only one slide. And what makes it like, these are the kind of things that make it easy to be really agile at my job, is that I just keep that slide deck updated and I won't do any additional prep docs. So we're going to RSA. Okay, great. Look at slides 3, 17, 19, and no, 19 and 20. Because I find that if you try to give executives too much prep, they're just not going to be able to get to like, you know, the main points and then be able to remember that for the discussion with the analyst.
That's really cool. And I like what you're saying. And I think I've evolved generally when it comes to prepping executives, no matter what we're talking about, with a less is more approach. And I equate it to a golf swing. It's like, if I'm going to go play golf, I don't want to remember to keep my head down, to keep my hands forward, to keep my feet, you know, the certain weight on one foot, like 15 different things while I'm trying to execute a very basic movement. Yeah. And I think that is a really analogous to what we're talking about here, is like, don't bombard people with too much stuff that will just make the anxiety levels rise and prohibit you from being liberated from all of these.
I have a question. Yeah. Do you think the reason for that, because I am the same way too, I used to give a ton of information. Do you think that the reason for that is now with everyone can access all the information that they need, that we assume that people will get the information that they need if they want it? So we supply the information that they have to have in that moment, that we want them to have in that moment. You know what I mean? Like, this is the messaging that you need to have, and this is the information that you have to have in this moment. But like, if you want to know, you know, where that guy grew up or what college he went to, like, you can look that up if you need to. Like, it's just an interesting, like, I don't know. I wonder if that's the reason why we suddenly are not carrying around binders full of information anymore, as we just assume that the interwebs are at our fingertips with binders.
So I have a take on that, and then also a take on golf. So my take on that is that I feel like, and maybe it's the same in public relations, analyst relations used to be a lot more formal and a lot more scripted. So it was like, here are the 15 key points I want you to get across. And now I think it's really evolved into being a lot more relationship based, a lot more just like video based and authentic, and like, go in there, address this one point they brought up in their last report, or bring up this topic that you're both really passionate about and have a really great discussion about it. And like, the how you interact and being authentic, it comes across so much better than being over-prepped. And on the golf side, so Perry, my husband is a longtime golfer. I took up golf last year. I absolutely love it. And nice. I agree. When I get in my head too much and I think like, okay, weight on my left foot, and then I need to keep this arm straight, but like, I need to aim here, and I need to like hit like under the ball, like an inch before it. I was not making any progress. And then finally, like I got some coaching and I got the feel of it. And I'm like, okay, this is the feel of it. And then I started to play a lot better, still a lot better at the 19th hole than the first 18, but I'm trying and I absolutely love it. We have this great group of women who golfs every Wednesday and everyone is from completely different, you know, different industries, whether they have their own business or some are in marketing, a few are lawyers. And then we golf and then we sit and like talk about the industry and it's so much fun. I love golf. That's awesome. I wish I would have discovered it earlier.
Quick little note for those watching who may not be golfers. The 19th hole refers to the drinks you have at the bar afterward. That's point one. Point two
I
is
didn't know that.
Your husband will be delighted to know that this past winter I put a golf simulator in my own house. So the winter does not suck anymore because I'm able to play golf literally all year round in the Boston area.
That's our bucket list. We're actually thinking about at one point doing that. And it was not, I was very skeptical before. Now I'm all for it.
You should email me if you want some tips, because I have a kick-ass system that is a lot of fun, but more importantly, it's excellent for the practice. So you're not thinking all those thoughts when you're on the course because you worked it out in your head.
Love it.
Wow. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go to the rapid fire questions, but only because one of them I know is going to take me off topic into something else for a moment. So it's going to end up being rapid fire with a segue back to rapid one. Fire. Peppery mm-hmm. fire. Mm-hmm. Rapidish fire. Okay. Boink, boink, boink. Let me find my rapid fire questions. Ready? We ready, Alyssa?
I'm ready.
What is a myth or misconception about communications that drives you crazy?
I love that. So I'm going to do one for AR and one for PR. Perry already addressed my AR one, which is AR is pay for play, which is not true. For PR, I hate the misconception that PR is easy. It's really hard and it's hard to do it really well. And I have so much respect for the PR colleagues I've worked with over the years. That's a huge pet peeve of mine.
Awesome. I have a question on that. Have you ever worked in PR or have you always done non-PR communications roles?
Yeah. So I've primarily done analyst relations. I've managed a PR team before when I managed a bigger team that had AR and PR there. And then I've done executive communications a couple of times, another field of comms that I absolutely love. Worked for a kick-ass female CIO named Alvina Antar. She's great. So I worked with her on some PR opportunities as well. But PR has never been like my only job at the time.
Yeah, PR is super easy until you're on the hook for the results. That's what
exactly.
I
exactly. So easy.
But don't you just write press releases all day?
Exactly.
The media just flows. That's mm-hmm. it. Yeah. Yep. Okay. You get to erase one corporate buzzword from existence. What is it?
Can it be two words?
Sure.
Good enough.
Oh,
I absolutely hate, and it's funny because it came up in like in a Wiz meeting today. To me, you're either all in, you're passionate, you're like working towards something and you have really lofty goals, or you don't do it. That like, we'll do like a good enough, you know, job at it. That is my absolute pet peeve.
We got to riff a little bit here. So first of all, there's a Yoda thing. It's like there is no try, only do. Yeah. Do or do not, there is no try, right? Like that's the one. And my Yoda impression is spot on. You guys are jealous. Just like that. That was amazing. But what about the – so I sometimes say like, hey, let's not let perfect be the enemy of the good here. Let's ship that thing rather than, you know, analysis paralysis. Are we at odds?
No, because I don't think it's doesn't have to be perfect. But it has to have passion behind it and drive behind it. Doesn't need to be perfect. In fact, I think a lot of times when you're empowered and you're taking risks, it's not going to be perfect. But it can't just be something like that, okay, we're just going to kind of do
this. You got to bring your whole heart.
Yeah, absolutely. Even if it's something small, big, you've really got to put your heart and your team into it. And also if you're managing a team, like it's not very motivational, be like, yeah, let's just do a good enough job on this. It's fine. We'll check a box.
Yeah.
And your results are going to be good enough. And that's time you could have spent working on something that's really great and that you're passionate
conviction.
About.
You need to have conviction.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you need to have your chair adjusted.
Did you see that? What I was trying to do was adjust my arm.
You got a foot and a half shorter all of a sudden.
I shouldn't be allowed in my office, I swear. Okay, next question. If you had to do a TED Talk on anything but marketing or communications, what would your topic be?
My topic would be about neuroinclusion. Some call it neurodiversity, both in the workplace and in schools, and why it is a huge benefit and the right thing to do, and actually even a competitive advantage for companies.
And that's the one that I knew I was going to have to dig into, because that's another thing that we've already talked about in our past lives and conversations, because it's something that we're passionate about. So why is that your topic, and what makes you passionate about it? And why do you think that this is something that needs to be talked about?
Absolutely. So for a couple of reasons, it was inspired because my son, George, who is now 10, was 3 when he was diagnosed on the autism spectrum at the amazing Mass General Lurie Center, where I spend time volunteering and engaging with them. They're just the most phenomenal program. And on the car ride back from learning about his diagnosis, I was already looking into therapies and what are some mainstream options for school. And right away, my husband and I were very passionate about so kids have a lot to learn from him, and he has a lot to learn from other kids. So it really started about this, this inclusion in schools, something we were really, really passionate about. And we've been lucky that our public schools are amazing. And he learns a lot from other kids about sports and sharing and about, social communication. And they learn a lot from him about just appreciating people's differences and appreciating a really quirky, amazing, fun personality. So that's where it really started. But then I was at Okta and also really learning a lot about, neuroinclusion, and then became one of the founding members of a neurodiversity employee resource group, where we did a few things. We both did some training for managers about neuroinclusion, what it is, what it looks like in hiring, what it looks like in managing, what it looks like for designing a team offsite, small things that you can do to create a more neuroinclusive neuroinclusive environment. And then also I headed up a kind of a subcommittee that was about connecting parents who have neurodiverse kids with each other. So when George was diagnosed and he was 3, I did not know any other working parents who maintained pretty intense jobs and also juggled therapies and evaluations and just really hard days. And then I met my squad of moms who are unbelievable and all support each other and, help each other out, and we're there on good days and bad days. And so what we did was we were able to match up employees. Let's say somebody had a child who was diagnosed when they were 3 and somebody else then just had someone diagnosed. We could connect them together so that they could talk about that and talk about best practices or just, be there for each other.
That's awesome. And I actually think now that's how we met, isn't it? Through the Neurodiversity ERG. Yeah. So that's so cool. And I do think, these conversations, I'm glad that that would be your topic that you would educate people about, because I think it's to your point, your son goes to a school where people have stuff to learn from him and he has stuff to learn. I mean, that's every kid, right? All of us exist on some spectrum of brain differences. And yes, there is a spectrum of things that are quote more normal and things that are outside the range of quote normal, but really neurodiversity is diversity. And I love that this conversation is a conversation now. So for what it's worth, thank you for being another advocate as part of this conversation. And this comes up on this podcast all the time.
That's awesome. And I have to ask one question, because you said something that I think a lot of people would, it would have their eyebrows raised, which is a competitive advantage having some of these folks working with. Can you kind of elaborate on what you might mean by that?
Absolutely. There are some articles that are written out there about it too. So those who are neurodiverse have a different approach to solving problems. And so if you have teams that have those neurodiverse individuals on them, they might see something that somebody else wouldn't. They might have an approach that someone else wouldn't. They may be able to, you know, the most common example is looking at a line of code very quickly, being able to go like, nope, something's wrong, you know, right there. But even thinking about like much bigger problems that you're trying to solve or just brainstorming, they're going to come up with really different, really, really cool ideas just because their brain works in a different way.
I love that. And just one riff on that. I'm thinking as you're talking, it almost might be a really big advantage in the era of AI, in the sense that AI and For sure. large language models, essentially what you're getting is the average of everyone else's thoughts.
Yes.
Whereas someone who's neurodivergent and brings that outside perspective might be able to add something very quickly to otherwise sort of milquetoast, banal sameness stuff. So that's a fascinating thing to think about, right?
Think about this. Think about the 5-10 most innovative people that have existed throughout history. You know, think of who they are: entrepreneurs, scientists, artists, mathematicians, whatever. They're all neurodivergent, all of them. You know, like you can clearly diagnose them by, you know, looking back at what their quirks are or whatever, or looking at the ones that are alive right now. I mean, you just saw Microsoft, Bill Gates. He just was like, well, if I had been a kid now, I would definitely be diagnosed with autism because, you know, duh. And, you know, duh, Richard Branson is dyslexic. And he's like, if I wasn't dyslexic, I sure as shit wouldn't be this, right? Yeah. And I am who I am because of my ADHD. And like, would I trade my ability to like go to the grocery store and like do my laundry? And like, yes, there's a lot of really shitty stuff that comes with it that like makes life really hard, but like, I wouldn't trade it. Like I would take the hard stuff for all of like the good, like you said, the outside the box stuff that comes with it, because that's how my brain works. And it, for me, that works, you know, and to your point, it's not vanilla. So thank you for that.
Of course.
Anything else on that point before I go to the rest of our rapid fire questions?
Now
let's go. Let's rapid fire it up.
Rapid fire. Okay, we got two more. You're about to give a presentation in front of 50,000 people. What's your walkout song?
Taylor Swift style. I'm a huge Swiftie. Went to the Eras tour, but it's also just like that beat and like the pace. You gotta give credit to Taylor, and that's just a phenomenal song.
I think that's a good walkout song. I like it. Okay. One emoji. You get to use one emoji for the rest of your life. Which one?
Oh, the eek emoji. That's my favorite. You can use it in so many ways.
What's the eek emoji?
Like the yikes. Yikes. Yeah. Face with the teeth like
open. Yes.
Yikes.
I love
my big teeth. I like that one.
Business, and it's like it's playful and cute and, you know, and fun,
or a cringe, yeah, if you want to cringe.
Eek is my favorite. Mm-hmm. Eek is my favorite, absolutely. Yes. Eek is the best movie by far.
Are we doing the
full weird? We're gonna start weird, we're gonna end weird.
Love it. Bring on
take it away.
All right. This one, I think I know what you're going to say, because I feel I have a good read on you as a human being based on your answer to the first question. In other words, you're a rational human being, somebody who thinks things clearly, isn't, you know, willy-nilly flying off the handle with crazy thoughts. All right, here's the scenario. You can have hiccups, like a regular hiccup, around the clock for 3 full months. You cannot avoid it. You will have it even when you sleep. Or you can end that problem by removing your pinky. Do you keep the hiccups 3 months straight around the clock, or do you sever a limb?
Oh, hiccups For sure.
See? There's no doubt in my mind she was going to say that.
Take a really good sleeping pill. Like, you know, apologize, explain the situation to people, explain the importance of your pinky.
You how would you talk about a pinky suicide. Too, Harry?
Like, screw up your grip.
Becca would cut off her pinky. So half of our guests that we've asked that question to would cut off their damn pinky.
I'm also not an athlete.
Some of them don't even hesitate. They're like, oh, pinky, obviously. I'm like, what?
But it's only obviously. 3 months, though. 3 months is pretty short.
Have
you ever had the hiccups?
I have.
For a day? Or for more than a day? Okay.
It's frustrating, but I really value having my pinky.
Can't do it. Yes. No way. Cannot do it.
We started this podcast with like Becca and I having the connection and being friends, and Perry,
we're now, done. Like,
you and I have really become friends because we're lot more aligned. On this
that's right, Alyssa. High four.
You guys can go golf with all of your fingers, and I will just be here typing with my 9 fingers behind my keyboard over here.
Oh, man.
And with that, I guess we'll call it a show. Thanks for joining us, Alyssa.
Thanks a lot. It's been great.
Actually, I need to give you your chance to, like, you know, do you have anything you want to plug? Can you, do you know, you want to say something? Anyone think?
No, just, you know, thank you. Thank you so much for having me. I'll also just plug that I have such a passion for analyst relations. Interesting is I report up into product marketing now, which is also an awesome place for analyst relations to go because my teammates are talking about the product ins and outs and the roadmap, you know, all day long. So I'm learning about the product. So, and just also that if, you know, anyone ever wants to chat about AR, I'm super passionate about it. I've built a career about it. And I'm just really excited about the field of AR and how it's modernizing and how it's, you know, evolving. Feel free to reach out.